Welcome to the People Who Read People podcast with me, Zach Elwood. This is a podcast aimed at better understanding others and better understanding ourselves. You can learn more about it at behavior-podcast.com. America is deeply divided. A significant percentage of the country, roughly 60% of Republican voters, according to polls, believes that the 2020 election was not legitimate. In a previous podcast, an interview with Thomas Popinski, we talked about that topic. We delved into some skepticism I had about what we can really tell from such surveys. For example, are some people who say the election was rigged on surveys just lashing out, just expressing frustration and suspicion in a similar way to how that may have been the case for some Democrat voters in 2016 who said the same thing about Trump's election? Clearly, distrust in our elections is a serious and concerning thing, especially when political leaders promote it. But I think we should be hesitant to reach firm conclusions about what such surveys tell us, considering how polarized we are and how our emotions can affect our answers. Related to these topics, you may have seen views expressed in articles and on TV news about the idea that America runs the risk of descending into a civil war of some sort with significant violence. Often, as evidence to bolster these views, people will point to a specific recent survey that showed that the number of Americans who think that political violence may be justified has gone up significantly over the last few years. And that is worrying, but again, it seems some skepticism and uncertainty is also warranted. What exactly are those polls asking and what factors might be influencing people's responses? Are there dangers to taking the worst case, most pessimistic interpretations of the data from such surveys, and how those interpretations might increase the fear and anger of people across the board? I'll read from a Washington Post article from January 2022 by Philip Bump. That there has been a broad discussion in recent days of the prospect of civil war in the United States is by itself telling. What drives public conversations is often nebulous, but here the proximate cause is obvious. 1 year ago Thursday, a violent mob surged into the Capitol in an effort to block the election of Joe Biden. So we've seen a multi-pronged discussion about the willingness of Americans to engage in acts of political violence and how far that willingness might extend. For Vox, Zach Beauchamp spoke with a number of historians and political scientists about the possible trajectories on which the country might be headed. Titled, How Does This End?, the essay summarizes the predictions of those with whom he spoke. Hotly contested elections whose legitimacy is doubted by the losing side, massive street demonstrations, a paralyzed Congress, and even lethal violence among partisans. But there were also notes of caution. Political scientist Josh Kurtzer found one component of Beauchamp's essay puzzling. I know a lot of Civil War scholars, and very few of them think the United States is on the precipice of a civil war, Kurtzer wrote on Twitter. Meanwhile, journalist Josh Barrow thought Waldman's essay was frustrating. There's this whole segment that wants to talk more about authoritarianism, he wrote, describing one facet of the essay. To what end? Who are you convincing of what? Last month, I spoke with American University Associate Professor Thomas Zaitsoff on this subject. His focus is political violence and political psychology, and he had publicly objected to a different Post column elevating the concerns expressed by Barbara F. Walter. Walter is a professor at the University of California at San Diego who wrote a soon-to-be-published book titled How Civil Wars Start. She was also one of the featured experts in Beauchamp's essay. Zaitsoff's objections were varied. One, he explained to me, was that elevating concerns about civil war could be self-fulfilling. He used the example of two feuding neighbors who observe each other buying weapons and ammunition. The instinct would be to be similarly prepared, raising the risk of a confrontation. Another objection Zaitsoff offered was that surveys suggesting broad support for violence were often vastly overstating the effect, as demonstrated in part by the rarity of such events, particularly compared with the 1960s and the 1970s, he pointed out, a period when political violence was far, far more common. So that was from the Washington Post article. So this episode of mine will be a talk with Thomas Zaitsoff, who was quoted in that Post article I just read. I first noticed Thomas's work on Twitter, where he had a Twitter thread making the points he made in that article. I'll read Thomas's full Twitter thread about that later. Thomas has also studied how social media can affect conflicts and wars, and he's done research on Ukraine. So we also talk a bit about his takes on the Ukraine-Russia conflict and about social media effects on society in general. Here's a little bit about Thomas taken from his site, Zeitzoff.com. That's Zeitzoff. He's an associate professor in the School of Public Affairs at American University. His research focuses on political violence and political psychology. He's particularly interested in the effects of social media and exposure to violence on political attitudes, why individuals fight, and how leaders mobilize supporters for conflict or peace. His research uses survey and experimental methods drawn from social psychology and behavioral economics, along with large N analysis. You can follow Thomas on Twitter at Zeitzoff. I've edited this interview a bit. Thomas and I talked first about the Ukraine-Russia conflict and the role of social media, but I've moved that to the end of the interview. So I'll start first with reading the Twitter thread that originally motivated me to want to interview Thomas. Here it is. Some thoughts on the idea that the U.S. is headed towards a civil war. 1. Polarization doesn't inevitably lead to civil war. 2. There's lots of other types of contention and violence that are more likely and common than civil wars. Riots, protests, intimidation, etc. 3. Focusing on the threat of civil war misses the nonviolent attacks on U.S. democracy that are happening at the state level and that are more consequential. 4. Like a bank run, repeatedly saying that we're headed towards a civil war can be a self-fulfilling prophecy. 5. In this debate, academics should offer sober analysis backed by evidence and highlight unforeseen threats. They should not indulge in sensationalist claims that we are likely headed towards a new civil war. So that was the Twitter thread from Thomas. Let's go now to the interview with Thomas Zeitzoff. How concerned are you that influential people are crafting some very pessimistic and worst case framings about the likelihood of violent outcomes in America and are unintentionally making worst case scenarios more likely?
I'm concerned because I think, again, right, just like we were talking about how most people don't follow politics closely or care that much about politics, I also think that what's way overstated is the percent of people who actually support violence, right? We're talking about maybe 5 to 7% of, you know, the US population, maybe 12%, depending on how you're framing it. And if you have like a really, you know, kind of quirky question framing, you could maybe get it to 15%. So this is still like a very small subset of the population. But right, political violence is never, you know, generally, I wouldn't say never. I would say generally it's not framed as, look, let's go out and smash the other side. Right. It's not we're going to just aggressively, you know, go out there and beat people up. It's almost always framed in a kind of protective, right, framework is the other side is so bad, right, that we have to do something extraordinary. And I remember the now disgraced former head of Liberty University, Jerry Falwell Jr., had this, I think, tweet that kind of summarizes the view of basically, because one of the criticisms that a lot of evangelicals and Republicans were getting about their like full-throated support of former President Trump was, how can you support this person, right? He's done all these things that are antithetical kind of to your worldview. He's an adulterer, he's a self-proclaimed liar, cheater, etc. And Falwell kind of responded and said, basically, this is his tweet verbatim, is conservatives and Christians need to stop electing quote unquote nice guys. They might make great Christian leaders, but the US needs street fighters like Donald Trump at every level of government because the liberal fascist Dems are playing for keeps and many Republican leaders are a bunch of wimps. And so that's basically saying, hey, the other side is so terrible. Liberal fascist Dems, right? That's not a small way of, it's not a, I respectfully disagree with esteemed colleagues, Democratic colleagues. And so I think, you know, when you amp up these perceptions that violence is coming, right? And particularly you amp up the belief that they want to destroy us, right? That's when you can get a really bad spiral. And so that's why I think a lot of political scientists who study political violence are very queasy, both, you know, in the sense that I don't think it's likely that we end up in a civil war. I think that's very unlikely, right? And we can talk about more why that I think that's very unlikely. But also that idea of we're headed towards a civil war also has this kind of, not a self-fulfilling prophecy, but a little bit of, well, if that's where we're headed, then we need to play hardball and kind of screw the other side.
And one thing that struck me in this area, and you can tell me if I'm off base or not, it seems that the more academic and scholarly someone is on these topics related to political violence and democracy denigration and those kind of things, the more measured and careful and uncertain they are about, you know, when they talk about what our situation really is and how bad it is. And it seems that the more incendiary, extreme kind of takes often come from, you know, people who are more just writers, journalists, pundits, some of them not that knowledgeable about history or political violence in general, often just general culture or politics writers who might seem a bit myopic about these topics. And it seems that we're sometimes being driven into a frenzy by the least knowledgeable people. And I'm curious what you think of that observation.
Yeah, so I was just kind of looking. I would say I largely agree with that, right? Is like people who are saying we're headed towards a civil war, you know, it's partisan pundits who are trying to get attention, right? Or, you know, sometimes scholars are like pushing some of those viewpoints. And if you actually read what they're pushing, it's actually much more nuanced. And it's like, well, if we categorize the civil war as, you know, sustained combat between two sides, and, you know, you have some fatalities, it's like, well, you know, the political violence that we've had for the last like 8 to 10 years, right, could be classified, you know, I don't think we're in a civil war, right? Until, you know, we see people in the military, right, actively rebelling, and then that's where you have to really, really worry, right? But that's not, we're not anywhere close to that. I do think, though, your point about, I think academics and people who study political violence and democratic decline are very careful, but I think some of them are also worried, and they're, I think they're worried less about, you know, the possibility of a civil war, but more about the worry of what does it mean when, you know, it becomes hard for, you know, one side to actually win free and fair elections, right? And I think that's the concern that a lot of folks have is, you know, the concern in 2020, and I think beyond, is will Republicans accept Democrats winning? And if they don't,
what happens?
Right? Yeah. and that's I think the big concern. Like Daniel Ziblatt, who was one of the co-authors on How Democracy Dies, and I think is not prone to, you know, hyperbolic statements, he's concerned and worried, and I am as well, right? Is that I'm less worried about a civil war, and I'm much more worried about what happens when we have close elections. I mean, we've been following what's been going on in Wisconsin with, you know, this fake review of kind of, you know, it's a sham. It's a partisan sham review saying they're going to take away and decertify Wisconsin's electors, right? There's no precedent for that. It's not legal, right? It's a bunch of pseudo, you know, basically pseudo partisan posturing. But the, you know, people always say the states are the laboratories of democracy. Also, they've been in the past laboratories of autocracy. A lot of our like democratic dysfunction, you can look at what happened in Wisconsin, in North Carolina, in Texas, right? In the lead up to 2020, is there a lot of these kinds of contentions over voting rights, over certifying election, over gerrymandering started in the states first. And so I think there is definitely a worry that, okay, what happens the next time the election is close and partisan election officials try to ram something through? What is the recourse for that?
Yeah. So, yeah, and to be clear, I think the takeaway is it makes sense logically to be worried and concerned about a whole range of things, but the there's that possibility that framing things as if these very violent outcomes are likely can accelerate the worst case things, which is, yeah, which I think we are on the same page there.
Yeah.
So maybe I thought it'd be interesting to get into a granular examination of what it means when people on surveys say something like, you know, that there are four, would theoretically be four violent action against the government. Because I think, you know, when I look at all these surveys recently of these kinds of questions and similar political questions, it always strikes me that there's various factors involved that make it hard to reach much confident conclusions about what those results mean. And I'll look at this poll that got a lot of attention recently about the Civil War and violence kind of topics. Was a 2021 poll by the Washington Post and University of Maryland. It got like 1,000 or so people responding. And the question that got the most attention was this one. Do you think it is ever justified for citizens to take violent action against the government, or is it never justified? And the answers one could choose were justified, never justified, or no opinion. And the newsworthy thing was that the number of people who said it was never justified had dropped from like 90% in the 90s to 62% with the latest poll. So about 1 in 3 people now said they believe that violence against the government can at times be justified, and that had increased substantially. So I'm curious, do you have any thoughts? Because there's a range of things you could point to in that question, that specific question, that would make it hard to draw from conclusions about what it means. And I'm curious if you have some thoughts about, you know, that question.
Yeah, I mean, we could, you know, this is like a very, like, actually, a very, like, what does it mean when people answer survey, you know, questions? I think that's like the...
In a polarized environment, yeah. Too. I think that's the other interesting
thing. Yeah. I mean, this is, you know, Phil Converse, John Zoller, all these, like, scholars, this is like, you know, it's like academics, you know, and political scientists, when we see this, we're like, oh, don't, you know, pull back the curtain on, like, how people answer surveys. We don't want to let the public know. But it's, I mean, yeah, it's complicated. So some people just say what's on the top of their head, right? Other people take cues from elites. You know, sometimes, you know, people also, like, there's, you know, evidence that certain, you know, survey respondents troll, right, people. Like, I always think of it back to when I was in middle school and elementary school, we would take these, you know, tests, like the national tests basically on substance abuse, where they would ask you, you know, have you done drugs? And they would always throw in like a fake drug, like Cromies, right? To see if, like, because there were people like in your class, there'd be like a couple of kids who would say, I've done it all. Meth, yes. Heroin, yes. Black tar heroin, yes. Crack cocaine. In fifth grade, I've been smoking it, right? And then, oh yeah, I did Cromies. But like that was to pick up people who were trolling. And I think there are people who do that as well. There's some evidence on that. So that's, you know, all the different ways that people can respond. And then when you think about like question wording, right? Are we talking about violence being justified? What do you mean by violence? Are you talking about, you know, taking up arms and actively protesting? Are you talking about maybe some kind of
throwing tea into the harbor?
Yeah. Or civil disobedience that's sort of not violent, but maybe is threatening? Are you talking about getting in people's faces and shouting? So that's a concern. I do think, though, that one thing that is fair is you can criticize a individual survey question for the snapshot that it is, but I do think the trend line is something to worry about for sure, right? That's a part where you can say, well, you know, presumably people who have taken this over time, right? Yes, there's issues with question wording and how people respond, but the changes or the shifts in that is something to be concerned about. And I think that's part of, you know, Liliana Mason and Nathan Calmo, one of their arguments, and I think probably one of the more convincing parts of their story is that, you know, even if violence is rare, right, and rarely acceptable, it's still more common in our politics than it was, you know, 10, 15, and, and 20 years ago. And that's something to worry about, this kind of politics of menace, as some people have put it.
And one thing, another thing for that survey is, you know, to read from an article about it. Previous surveys were conducted by phone, while the new poll was largely conducted online. And studies have found respondents are more willing to voice socially undesirable opinions in self-administered surveys than when asked by an interviewer. So that was theoretically another thing, getting into how people are more willing to say, you know, so antisocial things or whatever when they're distant from a survey taker.
No, yeah. And then, and don't, you know, when we could talk all about how it used to be that, you know, response rates for surveys have dropped, and, you know, it's crazy. Back in the day, they used to get like 70-80% of people would respond and be willing to take a telephone survey when Gallup and they started doing surveys, and now
it was exciting.
Yeah, no, it was. Yes, I would be delighted to give my opinion on Congress. I have 70% of Americans trust Congress. Right, we're way, way away from that.
Yeah, now we're bombarded with questions all the time, seeking our opinion, and we're kind of like burnt out. And you know, to the trolling point, you know, Trump has added to that in his, you know, animosity towards the media. I've seen conservatives basically say, like, when survey takers ask you questions, just lie to them because it's all fake news anyway, and we need to discredit them. So that's a real thing.
Or even if they're willing to answer the question, right? Is that, I mean, this is one of the big issues that happened in 2020 and in 2016, right? Is the national vote was pretty accurate, more or less, for Biden, but there were some like really big misses, and especially at the state level. And part of this is that there are certain people who maybe have, you know, they tend to be male, they tend to be, maybe have some high school, right? And they're you have very low trust, right? And we know that that is correlated with support for Trump. So it's actually really hard to figure out what are you supposed to do with that? Like the fact that, you know, you can't just reweight your survey. Those are people who are actually missing from the sample, but that matter a ton for voting, right? These are people who are socially alienated and or have low institutional trust. So they're not going to respond to your survey. And it's not that it's randomly Democrats or Republicans. It tends to skew towards Republicans, specifically towards people who are highly identified Trump supporters. So,
And to be clear, I agree that it is a worrisome trend, because clearly, you know, we've had street violence and such, and clearly we've had, you know, January 6th and things like that. But it's just interesting thinking the fact that we are a very polarized society can lend itself to answering questions that may not be what someone actually feels for various reasons. It can just be to vent or to score, feel like you're scoring a point against the other side, mm-hmm. these kinds of things. And then another interesting thing that occurred to me about that survey was just the sheer fact that we are so focused on politics on both sides. Like, you know, liberals have analogies they'll make to, you know, World War II or Nazi Germany or whatever, and conservatives have analogies they'll make to the Revolutionary War or what have you, and just being more aware of politics would make one more likely to answer yes to that question, because I think it's totally logical to answer yes to a theoretical question that, mm-hmm. you know, is it ever justified for citizens to take violent action against the government? I mean, clearly in some universe, even if you don't live in it, it can be justified to take violent action against
in
a government.
In Prague Spring,
you know, so
Tiananmen Square.
Yeah, it's like the question itself was not about America even. You know, it was just a theoretical question. And it made me think, well, yeah, I would answer yes to that, because obviously it's theoretically justified at some point. So I think there's an element of like even just being more aware of politics and political history would make one more likely to answer yes to that question, which we're all more focused on politics these days in general.
No, I think that's a good point.
It gets to these, you know, questioning these survey results, which I think they're valuable, don't get me wrong, and they do tell us important things. But I think it's getting back to our main point of like questioning, being skeptical of the most extreme interpretations of these things is a good thing to be. Yeah.
Yeah. No, and I think it also suggests, I mean, my view is that surveys are really useful and helpful for a lot of reasons, for getting the pulse, you know, how do people feel on issues, et cetera. But I think if we want to know where do we need to be concerned, it's at the elite level, right? That's the level, right? Mm-hmm. When we're talking about party activists, people who, you know, are, you know, serving in our election administration. The fact that we have partisan elections is also, you know, that's we can talk about that in a second. But I think that's where we want to be concerned is, right, who are the people who are very politically active, who are running caucuses and primaries and are shaping party platforms and are vetting candidates? How do they feel about mm-hmm. political violence mm-hmm. on the other side? And that there, I think, is actually, I think you can say that that's where we should be concerned in some respect, not so much about political violence, but about particularly respect for democracy.
Now, that's a great point. And I think I often point out that, you know, it's very important to distinguish between citizen behavior and political leader behavior. You know, you'll sometimes see people make that conflation that they are similar or the same, you know, like somebody, for example, might say like, well, I'll excuse Trump's behavior because of what these liberal citizens are doing. And it's like, that is those are two completely different things. Like I would never base my judgment of a leader and what their morality or the ethics based on what some random citizens are doing, because we have all kinds of, you know, citizens and I don't expect very much from them basically. So I think it is a very important point to distinguish those two things. And I think it gets into the basic polarization dynamics of tending to equate the entire other side as being like as bad as the worst people in that group, you know, which is one of the fundamental drivers of polarization. So yeah, distinguishing between that is super important.
Can I just want to add, I think, because I think this can even like clarify what happened on January 6th. So if we were to do a counterfactual kind of a what if history, imagine that you still have the Stop the Steal rally, you still have that movement, but Trump is not parroting it from the White House. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. right? So we've always had fringe movements in Congress, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's the unique part of Trump. In many ways, you know, there are a lot of unique parts, right? But I think that's one of the most important things is that he governed, and his rhetoric and his bombast that like a far kind of first term, you know, member of Congress, right, just trying to get attention, an outsider. And that spilled over into the rhetoric about Stop the Steal and the fact that there's always been Paul Gossers, there's always been Rand Pauls, mm-hmm. there's maybe a few more of them in some sense because of polarization, but it's the fact that Trump was there from the president saying all those things that I think really that was the signal, right? Mm-hmm. Because if the signal, right, if we think about this, you know, in terms of a coordination story, right? If a few members of Congress say something, you know, people aren't going to, you know, people will say, oh, look what they said, but it's not going to have the same effect as the leader of the party and the president of the United States is saying the election is stolen. You know, you need to be strong because they're not going to be strong. Go mm-hmm. tell them. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. I think that matters a ton.
Huge. Yeah, huge. And I think it gets to this, you know, being careful with where we direct our anger too, because to me, you know, my criticism is directed at the people I believe are directly responsible. I'm less, my anger and criticism is much less directed at, you know, the voters, for example, because I think, you know, voters can be influenced. They can, you know, when the president says something, they're going to be influenced, right? It's understandable in many ways how people come to believe things we strongly disagree with, you know, even if we mm-hmm. think they're wrong. So I think, yeah, I think it points to being, you know, thinking about where we direct our anger and our criticism, because acting as if, you know, a Trump voter who believes the election is rigged is an evil person who wants to destroy America is just as unhelpful as a conservative acting as if, you know, liberals are trying to destroy America. It lends itself to these, you know, large scale us versus them, we're at war kind of feelings when we should really just be focusing on these people that we can, you know, point to as being directly responsible. I just think it's helpful to think in those terms. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think one thing that's important to point out, like there's two things like I always think is as somebody who's spent a lot of time studying politics outside the US is compared to many other countries, right? We have this kind of weird combination is that we have very strong partisan polarization. So people feel very attached. They're increasingly less likely to vote across the aisle on all sorts of issues. But we also have comparatively weak parties, right? So parties in many other countries, right, they have internal elections. They're able to ferret out like people who maybe aren't in the best interest of joining their party, right? So somebody like Donald Trump never would have been allowed to run in Germany besides for his views or in Israel besides for their views, but because he wasn't even really a member of the party, right? Mm-hmm. Before, mm-hmm. like, so he never would have been allowed to be in that same position. And so I think that's one of the criticisms of kind of the US sort of system that we have, at least the party system we now have, is that, you know, there's a lot of criticisms you can make about the smoke-filled backroom deals that used to go on, you know, mm-hmm. in party conventions and other things. But there's a reason party leaders, right? You know, parties are not democracies, right? That's, I think, the other thing that people tend to conflate. Political parties don't, and in many cases, the most effective political parties are not like purely democratic, right? They are ways to basically funnel and sift through candidates who would be good electoral candidates and also mm-hmm. protect the party brand. And I think, you know, if we had stronger parties, you never would have seen Donald Trump being able to run. And also the other thing too is in most other countries he wouldn't be able to run again right after what happened on January 6th. So that's one of
And I was reading you know, that there's thoughts of how our, you know, governmental system lends itself to more conflict. Like I was reading Ezra Klein's mm-hmm. book, Why We're Polarized, and he had a really good description of the criticism of how we have we can have a president and the Congress at odds, and it lends itself to both sides not having an incentive to compromise, because by helping, you know, say you compromise and negotiated and help the other side, you're theoretically lending them a win and it's for the next election cycle, which would help them. So, and there's a reason why when America has helped set up democracies in other countries, we don't use the system we have for that reason. Mm-hmm. And so that these are all things that, you know, it's interesting examining the various factors that can lend themselves to polarization. And I think there's a lot of things, you know, that lend themselves to polarization.
Yeah. No, and I think the point that you made, like one of the biggest points, right, is the fact that in the US, if you get 50.001% of the vote, you get everything, right? And the person who got 49.999, sorry. And what that does is that, you know, especially with polarization, that just raises the stakes of every election, right? Whereas in a proportional representation system, it's like, oh, well, they get six seats and we get five. You know, that's not essentially, that's not do or die, right? It's not that we went from having complete representation to having no representation. It's they have slightly more than us, right? And that helps lower the temperature. I mean, this was, you know, the political scientist Juan Linz, this was always what he called the perils of presidentialism, right? And he always had this famous quote that basically said, you know, presidential systems like the United States are inherently unstable, with the exception being of the United States. I think that has changed.
Yeah, is he still alive? What's he saying?
No, he passed away recently.
So I see. Well, yeah. Yeah. I'm sure he would have been interested to see how things turned out. Not touched on something that you wanted to talk about in either in your research or in things we've talked about?
I think, I mean, one thing that I would say too is right about when you're talking about the Civil War stuff, kind of circling back to why the US is not headed towards a civil war, as one of my colleagues and friends, Dan Silverman, pointed out, is like the top predictors of a civil war are poverty, a weak state, you know, and lootable resources. And we don't really have any of those, right? Especially the kind of weak state. It's hard to see like the FBI and, you know, all of the different Homeland Security apparatuses that we have just basically saying, yeah, that's great. You know, we're totally going to allow this to carry on. What's very clear is when the FBI and, you know, the full weight of the US state decides this something is a threat, they have the capacity to take it down. And I think, you know, pretty effectively. And so I think that's, you know, whenever somebody tells me a story about how we're headed towards a civil war, I'm like, explain to me that sort of causal logic.
Well, and the lack of geographic separation seems pretty significant too. I mean, we're so interspersed. When I've thought through how that would look, it just seems, I can't even imagine how it would play out. I mean, I think it's much more logical to envision like a limited violent interaction in the Capitol or things like this, you know, it's just really hard to imagine how it would play out.
Yeah. And just because we don't have civil war doesn't mean we don't have contention and political violence. I think that's, you know, as we've seen, you know, and I also think it's helpful to sort of zoom out a little bit in that COVID, fingers crossed, things are starting to open up more. And this pandemic wave, hopefully, will recede, right? And hopefully, you know, that's where we're headed. But, you know, we've lost, you know, close to a million Americans. And this was a period of time that was a social pressure cooker. Like if you were to say, hey, I'm going to figure out a way to basically heighten as many social stressors as I can. It's okay, have a massive pandemic, close all the schools, put a lot of people who are unemployed, have a contentious election, have some of the largest social protests associated with Black Lives Matter, right, in the country. It's not surprising that this feels like a very kind of heightened, stressful period, because this is the definition of Emile Durkheim, the famous French, you know, sociologist, who talked about anomie, right? Social stress disorder.
Existential angst.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, totally. That's what worried me so much when COVID started. I was like, oh my, because I was always thinking like, well, we're okay as long as something really bad doesn't befall
us. Which
is
always a terrible attack. You can't put those words out there.
I know. During Trump's term, I was always really pessimistic. And I was like, as long as nothing really bad hits the economy, and then bam. Yeah.
Chekhov's gun.
That gets to the gun has to go off. Yeah, it's a bad script we're in, or you know, the simulation or whatever. But the you know, that also gets to some forgiveness, I think, in terms of like, you know, I've seen so much kind of arrogance about like how could those people have done that during January 6th. But it's like, to me, I mean, we're going through the COVID effects of both financial stress and existential stress, and I've seen that affect, you know, liberal people I know in terms of like being more willing to go out and go into the streets and fight the cops in Portland, for example. So I think it points to having some empathy for the fact that we are in tough times. No matter how much you disagree or think people are stupid or misled, I mean, we are in trying times, you know, in terms of COVID and how that affected us, and then our polarization and growing animosity. Mm-hmm. And I think it points to having a bit of empathy for the hardships that people can be going through, both psychologically and financially and stuff. Yeah.
No, I think that's right. I also think, I would say though, is that there is, you know, when we're thinking about what went on at the Capitol and the insurrection, and then we're getting more out that, you know, maybe it was not just an insurrection, but also potentially like an auto
grenade.
Which is very concerning. I think there, you know,
but separating people from the citizens and the leaders again.
There were people there who were for sure like MAGA tourists who were hopped up and excited and trespassing, but there were also people there for bad, you know, bad intentions, zip ties, with, you know, Oath Keepers, with, you know, bear spray, and, you know, were there to, even though it was unlikely to succeed, we're trying to basically overthrow the seat of power.
Yeah, and don't get me wrong, I'm not excusing all of that stuff. I'm more advocating for the less violent and less malicious people, and separating from the leaders and the citizens, kind of thing. I think there is something too, thinking about how, I think the DC police were woefully unprepared. It was clearly obvious that they did not think that a conservative crowd would do what they did. And it's interesting to think about how, if they had just been slightly more prepared, like none of that stuff would have ever happened, I don't think. And there's kind of something to, you know, in a different universe, they completely prevented any violence from getting out of hand, and it would have been just a standard protest in some ways. But yeah, not to say that this is not serious, because I fully believe it's serious, but it's just, there's a number of factors that went on that day, including like incompetent preparation by the police, in my opinion. So
I think that's completely right, is that it's kind of shocking that they knew and were monitoring, and yet there wasn't.
Pretty sad. I mean, because I fully expected it to be much worse than it was. Like, I knew something was going to happen that day, and a lot of people did, and it's kind of mind-blowing that they would not prepare for that. Anything else you want to throw in? I know we're need to get going, so.
Yeah, no, I mean, I would say my last thing is, you know, it's not a hobby horse, but I do think one of the things that's also interesting is to think, you know, about, okay, what are the future sort of cleavages and kind of lines of conflict that we're likely to see in kind of American politics and American society going forward. And my feel and my view is that the Biden presidency and kind of this period is actually kind of masked one of the big cleavages that I think is going to rear its head going forward in a pretty dramatic way. And that's the generational divide between boomers and kind of everyone else. And I think, you know, the fact that Biden is older and you have Nancy Pelosi and the Democratic leadership are older has kind of tamped that down. But if you look at the political views of, you know, baby boomers versus Gen Z and millennials, and especially as an elder millennial myself, who, you know, coming into my prime voting years, right, I think that's only going to be accentuated, because if you look at the views on racial issues, on the economy, on the environment is a huge one, where it's just diametrically opposed. And especially as boomers retire en masse and are like, well, I don't, you know, why should we have a social safety net? I want my social security check, right? Mm-hmm. I think it's going to be a pretty dramatic axis of conflict. And it's also a demographic one as well, because younger generations, my generation and Gen Z, are more diverse. Mm-hmm. There are more non-white people, right? And so I think a lot of the sort of Trumpy angst, and if you look at voting demographics, it kind of bears this out, right, is that it is also this generational conflict that, again, has been sort of tamped down, but I think will increasingly rear its head. And in fact, this is what I've argued to my baby boomer parents.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting question, because I like to think about, I like to consider what the future topics of polarization will be. You know, for example, cryptocurrency, you know, is already starting to be pretty polarized. You had Ted Cruz the other day tweet something about how, of course, liberals don't like cryptocurrency because it's unregulated. And it just points to, there's no limit to the kinds of things that could theoretically be drawn into these polarization dynamics. I mean, some of them are more, I think, more predictable, like yours, but there's also these range of things that, you know, as Michael Macy, the researcher, has examined, there's these things that don't have previous ties to existing political party stances, and they're liable to go either way depending on the chaos of polarization, you know. So I know you got to get going. So is there anything you want to say about how people can keep in touch with your work?
Yeah, sure. You follow me on Twitter, Zaitsov.com, or my website. And this was great, Zach. This was awesome to have a conversation. And also, it's funny, your crypto point also made me think too, right, that it's, if you look at like the Bitcoin crypto sort of caucus in Congress, it's strange bedfellows, right?
Mm-hmm. So I think, yeah, for sure.
So I think that's also something, is that there are these weird, like the same thing with the letter that was signed by Paul Gosar and AOC telling Biden, like, don't commit U.S. troops, right? Sometimes politics can make strange bedfellows, and, you know, mm-hmm. living through political realignment can be always very interesting, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So.
Okay, here's the section where Thomas and I talk about the Ukraine-Russia conflict and the role of social media in that. And also, we just talk about social media dynamics in general. So maybe we could start with your research on social media and how social media impacts conflicts and violence. I'm sure you have some thoughts on the Ukraine-Russia conflict and how social media may have changed things in that conflict. Maybe you care to talk about that a bit.
Sure. First of all, it's terrible what's going on there. I mean, I've alluded to when we were chatting previously, is, you know, Ukraine is a country where I visited a lot. I have friends, I have colleagues there, and, I've been staying in touch with them, which is, again, something that's, you know, before social media was very difficult, right? before WhatsApp and other things. But, so at first, it's just terrible that there's basically this war, Putin's war, kind of unprovoked, against Ukraine. And I do think one of the interesting things, and I think, you know, one of the things that if you would ask political scientists and other folks, I think they would be shocked at basically how Russia, with, you know, the misinformation machine of Russia, has kind of basically seeded social media to Ukraine. I mean, I think there are pockets always within the internet in the West where you can find, obviously, folks that are supporting Russia, you know, whether it be Reuters or, you know, people associated with Nick Fuentes and some of those folks. But for the most part, right, mainstream social media coverage is decidedly pro-Ukrainian. And there are a lot of reasons for that. One is that, you know, it's very clear that this was a decision that Russia made to invade Ukraine kind of without provocation. They tried to manufacture one. But even more so, right, you know, people like David Goliath's story, and then Ukraine's, you know, kind of unique, you know, president Volodymyr Zelensky as a background, as an actor, it's kind of, you know, story that, you know, if Tom Hanks starred in a movie about, or a TV show about him becoming president of the U.S. called The American President, then starts a political party called The American President, then actually wins office, and then 3 years later is caught in a war. It's, I mean, you would say that's a farce. That's, you know, ridiculous. That's what's actually happening in Ukraine. And I think so that makes it for a very compelling story. And, you know, Zelensky, you know, he's a comedian, showman kind of, and he's, I think his leadership has surprised a lot of folks. So I think that also plays into it.
A lot of charisma.
Yeah, for sure. So, yeah, I mean, I think social media has played a big part, but I think it has been, you know, way more lopsided towards Ukraine and rallying folks.
Yeah, I'm curious about that, because the one thing that strikes me there is you would expect Russia, with all of their history of being pretty skilled, or at least very focused on disinformation and manipulation, you would think all the things that have happened would be foreseeable. Just, you know, Putin's supposed to be smart and good at manipulation and things like that. So I'm kind of curious, like, why do you think Putin wouldn't have foreseen the things that are happening now as happening?
Yeah, I mean, so one of my colleagues had like this great thread, is like, what are you, you know, how has the large-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine changed? What have you updated after, you know, the invasion? And I think one of them, and, you know, I remember talking to another colleague who said, you know, that Putin is, I think, much more ideological than the West. I think many people realize, right? And I think that's kind of been revealed, right? Is that he's way more ideological in making these choices. I also think the other thing too is, right, as we talked about, the Russian disinformation machine. And I'm more of kind of a skeptic in terms of, like, I think a lot of people, it's very easy to blame, like, you know, like include that social media did it, right? Social media murdered American democracy or something like that, which I think is one, besides being like hyperbolic, is also like incorrect. I think the reason why sometimes, you know, Russian misinformation campaigns were effective is because they were essentially laundered through opinion leaders, particularly, you know, in the Republican Party, you know, with the exception of a few corners and maybe like Tucker Carlson. For the most part, most Republicans are, you know, it's like you can have whiplash, right? That they voted against Trump for holding up weapons, for basically doing a shakedown on Volodymyr Zelensky in October of 2019. But what's interesting, right, is now they're very much pro-Ukrainian. So, right, I think there's also not that kind of like fertile conduit for Putin to sort of push his, you know, and launder kind of Russian misinformation. So it looks very clunky.
Anything you want to say about your past research into social media and how it affects conflicts and how you see that playing out now?
I think there is a tendency to view social media as this great kind of persuasion machine. And I actually think persuasion is really hard. I think what social media can do, right? And again, most people aren't, you know, consuming information on Ukraine, right? Most average Americans, I mean, they're seeing maybe a few things, but instead they're watching TikToks, right? They're, you know, thinking about Dancing with the Stars or other sort of pop culture things. But for elites who pay attention a lot, right, this has been, you know, a way for them to get a window into the conflict, and particularly a pro-Ukrainian window into the conflict. And the Ukrainians have done a very good job of this. And I think a lot of people are surprised at the swiftness of sanctions towards Russia and also towards European Union support for Ukraine, whether it be weapons, you know, other kinds of financial guarantees, right? That's a big deal. And I think that's another thing that people wouldn't have guessed ex ante. And I think part of that, again, is, you know, for people to very much see, you know, within, you know, different European capitals getting kind of this very pro Ukrainian anti-Russian viewpoint. I mean, I think it also, you know, doesn't help that, like, again, Ukraine is a much weaker military country that, you know, Putin clearly invaded and tried to engineer through ridiculous provocations.
Yeah, that gets into something I was thinking about recently, was the exaggerated views people have about the influence of social media, or maybe media in general. Like I interviewed Dave Karp, a political scientists about this, and we talked about the exaggerated views that, for example, Cambridge Analytica had a big role in the well-known fact that political ads in general just don't do that much compared to other factors. You can see social media as, on the one hand, it's an influential, like it can be persuasive, but on the other hand, the huge amount of media and content leads to some burnout, you know, with too much content and desensitization with so much content. I think, you know, that those kinds of things kind of can balance each other out. You know, it's like you see so many things and you're like, well, is that really real? Is that really real? So there's various, it's a lot more complex, I think, than people think. And that kind of gets into, you know, I think a good tie-in maybe when we talk about the effects of social media. I mean, some people act as if it's some like separate sphere, like it's separate from other media, like it's separate from cable news, you know, but all these things could be seen to be just an acceleration of being bombarded with different views and different ideas, like the cable news channels, you know, in the internet age or the modern age, amplified our bombardment with all of these things. And then social media is just adding another layer on top of that and making it more interactive, which maybe engages our emotions more. But I'm curious if you see, you know, these things as, you know, being a lot more complicated than is often talked about.
Yeah, I mean, you're going to get the academic version of me that says, yes, it's more complicated, right? But I think it's complicated in, like, in, you know, it's maybe helpful, like, and I think you teed it up nicely to think about some of these things of how it's more complicated. So I think one of the things that people mistake is they mistake clicks and engagement for persuasion. So I can get you to click on something, right? That's very easy. I show you something super provocative, like, you know, 10 things about Barack Obama and Joe Biden's secret relationship. You know, number 9 is going to blow your mind. If I had like some really nice graphic, I could get you to click on that, right? Am I going to persuade you to vote against Joe Biden or Barack Obama? Probably not, right? So that's, I think, one of the things. I think the other thing, too, is that, you know, when we're thinking about like these strategies for what is social media doing? So the kind of conventional wisdom, like that Russia hacked our democracy, or social media is killing our democracy, or, you know, Facebook is engineering people to be, you know, it is engineering people to be really unhappy. I think that's way overblown, right? That's the persuasion story. I think the understudied part of this is the coordination story, right? So it's not that, you know, social media is changing people's minds, but maybe what social media is doing, already people, for instance, in the Ukraine case, people, you, the Russia-Ukraine war, right? People who already maybe sent, you know, sympathetic to the Ukrainian cause are becoming more aware of it and they want to do something about it, right? So I think instead of persuasion, you're maybe getting an activation effect, right? And that's a different story. But I think it's also, I think it's an important.
Yeah. And then there's, you know, it's kind of this magnification effect. It's like focusing everyone's attention on one thing, which is a relatively new phenomenon, you know, but it blends into exactly what cable news does. It's just on a broader scale, you know, the ability to focus a large population's attention on one thing is a relatively new phenomenon. And it leads to, you know, it can lead to exaggerations or overcorrections and overreactions, but it's a continuation of things that have already been happening in other media.
But do you think, I mean, yeah, but I mean, the one point where I would like push back, so I totally agree, right, is that you can't separate what happened with like on Twitter from the fact that tweets also get blasted across Fox News and CNN, right? So like, if Trump is not, when he was president, he was not tweeting in this just into Twitter, they would get covered, right? His tweets and other things. And so that was part of that ecosystem. But I also think the other thing too that we forget is, right, is that, you know, one of my good friends and colleagues, Michael Bang Petersen, he's a professor at Aarhus in Denmark, and he gave this really amazing, he had this really nice, you know, thread on Twitter about social media. It was very meta, right? About his testimony that he gave in front of the Danish parliament, right? Is that like, and to summarize what he was saying is that social media is basically a place of very intense polarization, right? Where people, it's kind of like the angriest corners of politics.
A little note here. Previously, I interviewed Kevin Arsenault, who worked with Michael Bang Petersen on research into so-called need for chaos views. The need for chaos views are antisocial and burn it all down views that a surprisingly large number of people seem to have these days, at least according to that research. Kevin and I talked about what the causes for those views might be and how social media might give people with those views more power. Back to the interview.
It reflects offline cleavages, but I think the additional addendum to that is most people don't care about politics, right? Most people care more about sports. They care more about other things. They have a very surface level understanding. So the people that care very intensely about politics and are following it on social media, those are people who are voting in primaries, right? I think the turnout for Democrats in the primary was 6%. And for Republicans, it was 11% in Texas, right, last night. That tells us something, right? That tells us, again, that, again, we're getting a very skewed view of the world, that social media reflects things that are important, but it's not a pulse of the nation, so to speak.
Right. And then the worrying nature of polarization is like people who previously, you know, we're not that interested in politics are increasingly drawn into these conflicts because it starts to feel like not just a political thing, but a cultural thing or even a war thing. So it becomes, you know, it becomes bigger than politics in a way for many people. And it starts to take on that form the worse things get, I would say.
Yeah, no, I think your point is right, is like, you know, I think there have been like polls that have been done about sort of people like who don't want to talk about politics at Thanksgiving and how that number has like increased across time linearly, right? So I do think one of the dangers, and you pointed out about polarization, is when people's party or who they voted for is not simply, it's not simply just a, this is who I voted for, but it also is a signal of this is the kind of car or truck I drive. This is the kind of sports I watch. I'm not a vegetarian or, you know, a latte sipping liberal, right?
Yeah, I eat just meat. How much I hate the other side. Yeah.
So I think that's like the part where that's kind of concerning in some ways, is when it kind of tips over into
more emotional.
Aspects. Yeah.
This has been the People Who Read People podcast with me, Zach Elwood. That was an interview with political scientist Thomas Zaitsev. If you want to look at some resources mentioned in this interview, go to my site, behavior-podcast.com, and check out the entry for this episode. If you enjoyed this episode, I think you'd also like some previous episodes I've done on similar topics, like the interview with Thomas Popinski, where we examined the question, how many Trump supporters actually believe the 2020 election was rigged? If you've enjoyed this podcast and found it interesting, please consider sharing it on social media and recommending it to your friends and family. I make no money on this podcast currently, and I spend a significant amount of time on it, so I'd appreciate anything you could do to help me find more of an audience. Also, if you'd leave a review on iTunes or another podcast platform, that would also be hugely appreciated. I also have a Patreon if you wanted to donate some money to encourage me in this work. That's at patreon.com/ZachElwood. That's ZACHELWOOD. You can follow me on Twitter at @apokerplayer. Thanks for listening. Music by Small Skies.